Welcome to episode 442 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. Jeff Sankoff. Jeff is an emergency physician, triathlete, and triathlon coach, and in this interview, we use his expertise as a medical doctor to discuss some of the most important and topical health and medicine-related questions for triathletes and endurance athletes. Before we get into that, though, I do want to mention here at the top of the episode that registration for our 2025 training camp in Mallorca is open. This camp will take place from the 5th to the 12th of April, and I'll give some more information after the interview. But in case you want to go and check it out right now, you can find out all the information on scientifictriathlon.com or through the link in the episode description. And as always, before we get to the main interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. And to me, the number one thing that any sports nutrition product needs to have is that they should not cause flavor fatigue, even in very long races, because a relatively minor reduction in carb intake from your plan could be the difference between a PB and walking the last 10 kilometers of the marathon in an Ironman, for example. So the product that you use needs to still be appealing enough for you to keep fueling at the end of the race. And this is one of the biggest advantages of Precision Fuel and Hydration's carbohydrate products. The flavor is quite neutral, only mildly sweet, making it quite easy to consume as much as you want for hours on end, so you can really stick to your plan throughout the race, or even increase your intake from your plan if you feel that you're a bit low on energy. You can get a free plan for your next race with the Fuel and Hydration Planner on the Precision Fuel and Hydration website, and as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer is a dry land swim bench that allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is the time commitment, especially for those living further away from the pool. If you need a 2 to 2.5 hour time window to be able to swim for 60 minutes or less than 60 minutes, perhaps, then it can make it very difficult to swim more than once or twice per week, as finding these time windows in a busy schedule is quite the challenge for most of us. If you are in this situation where you are restricted on how much you can swim, you can use the Senate to complement your pool swimming with quick and efficient home-based workouts that challenge the swim-specific muscles, including core strength and stability, and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when you have limited time in the water. You can try the Senate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesintrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Dr. Jeff Sankoff. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good as well. I think that you're fresh and ready after a very nice vacation. So let's use this opportunity to make a really good interview. Can you first start by introducing yourself to the audience?
Sure. So my name is Jeff Sankoff. I am an emergency physician. I live in Denver, Colorado, but I'm originally from Montreal in Canada. And I have been in the sport of triathlon for the past two decades or so. I started as a back of the pack age grouper. Over time, made myself a little bit better at the sport, and now am routinely in the front of my age group. I started coaching about 5 years ago, and I produce the TriDoc podcast, and that is a labor of love that I've been doing also for about 5 years.
Yeah, I think you have some really, really, really good episodes there on really good topics. So, and something that I don't think is done a lot in, there's not many podcasts that cover some of the topics that you do. So it's definitely something that I'll link to in the show notes, and I encourage listeners to go and I look at the episodes you have there, because I'm sure there will be a lot of things that can pique somebody's interest. But some of that we might cover in today's episode, because we'll just get your take on a number of the most important and most topical health-related topics for endurance athletes and triathletes in particular. And to start with, I want to ask you about longevity and lifespan, which are maybe slightly different, and you might get into that potentially. But what do we know about how doing endurance sports might or might not affect these two things?
Yeah, it's a question that I think is front of mind for a lot of people that get into endurance sport, particularly as they get older. we have really an abundance of research over the past several decades now that shows that a sedentary lifestyle, someone who spends more of their time on the couch, is more likely to encounter a host of problems as they get older in the form of more morbidity, meaning more disease, and earlier mortality. And that's across a population. Obviously, I can't speak to any one individual, but when we look at population statistics, we know that the more sedentary you are, the lower quality of life you're going to have in your older years. People who are active, and that doesn't have to be training for a triathlon, training for a marathon, but just being active in the form of 30 minutes a day of some kind of activity, have been shown to have significantly higher quality of life indices and overall improved mortality from things like cardiovascular ailments and all kinds of other disease processes, even cancers. So we know that being active is a good thing. But we also know that being active is a good thing, not just for physical health, but for mental health. People who are more active tend to have a more positive outlook on life. They tend to be happier people. And while there is probably some truth to the fact that happier people are more likely to be active, we also know that being active tends to make happier people. So there are a lot of reasons to be active. There's a lot of reasons to participate in endurance sport as that way of being active. And the research bears out that you can live not just a healthier life, but a more fulfilling life by doing so.
Every once in a while in regular media, I think that people come across headlines like something to the effect of a U-shaped effect of endurance training, that past a certain limit or a certain threshold, you actually get decreased life expectancy. Can you comment on that? What are those headlines correct in some way, or is it a misinterpretation of the research?
It's complicated, but the technical term is actually a reverse J curve, which is kind of funny because it is kind of a U. But basically, what it's referring to, and this really is seen mostly with cardiovascular research and high intensity endurance sport. So the kinds of things that I'm doing as an older individual, by that I mean in my late 50s, and performing high intensity training. And what the research has shown, that you can see a very, very clear decrease in mortality and morbidity associated with cardiovascular, all cause cardiovascular disease. So heart attacks, strokes, all of the things that we think about with cardiovascular disease, they decrease as you increase the amount of endurance activity per week. However, once you get to a kind of tipping point, which is around 10 hours per week of high intensity endurance, and high intensity is defined differently depending on who you ask, but generally we're talking about zone 3 or higher. So if you get to about 10 hours a week of zone 3 or higher efforts, then you start to see a loss of those benefits. And that's where, if you look at it as you chart it out, once you start getting to 11 hours, 12 hours, you start to see a reduction of those benefits, so that the curve kind of returns to zero. But I want to emphasize this, it never crosses back over. So if you compare somebody who's training at 12 hours per week, they still get cardiovascular benefits. They're just not getting the same benefits as they would if they were training 9 hours a week, because they've lost some of those benefits, because there is now a slight increase in risk compared to the person who is training 9 hours a week, but they are still benefiting versus the sedentary individuals who are not training at all. And I think that's the part that is lost in the media message, which is that, yes, this reverse J curve is real. It exists. We don't completely understand why, but even though it is there, people need to remember that although training more than 10 hours of high intensity per week at an older age is associated with a reduction in the benefits, that reduction is not an increase in risk versus a sedentary individual. It's just a reduction in benefits versus those who are training maybe less than 10 hours of high intensity per week. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting because I wasn't really aware of the fact that it applies to kind of 10 hours plus of higher intensity, so 3 and above, which, I mean, puts it in a different perspective to me, at least, because I think that very few people can actually do that consistently without going into overtraining or some kind of at least overreaching fatigue and having to back down. I think that very few people are capable of that, especially if we're talking about amateur athletes and older athletes for that matter. So maybe to some extent the problem takes care of itself. Your body will not let you train that much, at least in the athletes that I've coached. I don't think that many would be able to tolerate that amount of load. The hours, yes, in zone one, zone two, but when you go to zone three, then the fatigue builds up so quickly that I think it's quite unlikely that many people would achieve those amounts of higher intensity work on a consistent basis.
Yeah, and it brings up the point that as you get to those people who are training at those high hours of high intensity, it's a smaller population. So you're going to kind of magnify the risk then. And that makes it harder to really know how much this quantifies across the population. But still, I think the risk is real. We have to take it seriously. But there's been more recent studies that kind of make it really unclear as to what the cause is of this risk and why it's there. So, and we could talk about that later, but it's a really interesting kind of science. And I think everybody has to make a decision for themselves. I know I am very familiar with this data. I train anywhere between 12 and 16 hours a week. Obviously, that's not all high intensity. Much of that is zone two, like you said. But I've made the decision that I'm willing to live with that lower risk of benefit, knowing that I'm still getting a benefit, because the quality of life for me is so much better in the moment. So I'm willing to take the trade-off of maybe a slightly decreased benefit that I would have if I trained less.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the extreme example would be somebody trying to perhaps not die, but the extremes that a person can go to, as we see in today's society in some examples, is that really worth the effort? I think for most people the answer is no. So I think that's a good point. And also, just on this point, I did do an entire episode, this was a few years ago now, with the Dr. Melita McNary, who is a researcher who has investigated this issue, and they did a systematic review meta-analysis on the topic. So for some more detail, I would refer listeners to that, even though it is a bit older. And maybe you have done something new on your podcast, Jeff. Do you have anything?
Well, the biggest thing that I've done more recently is just a discussion of the Ventoux study, which came out very recently. And that was a study that looked at 106 cyclists. And it was a really interesting study because what they did is they took these cyclists and they did MRIs on all of them, cardiac MRIs, to look for the presence of fibrosis in the heart, which was one of the things that had been hypothesized as the potential for the cause for this reverse J curve. And what they found was that a lot of these 106 athletes had the presence of fibrosis in their heart. But if you followed these athletes for a year, which they did, they put loop recorders on them all. And so they were following them to see if any of them developed any kind of arrhythmias. There was a pretty high percentage of people who ended up getting arrhythmias. But the arrhythmias in all of these people tended to be asymptomatic. Most of them were insignificant. They tended to be 2 to 3 beats of unsustained arrhythmias, but they were noted just because they were on a loop recorder. And so the authors came out of this and said, we don't know what to do with this. We see that cardiac fibrosis tends to be common amongst older athletes. It did not seem to be related to how much these athletes were training. Athletes who trained less were just as likely to have fibrosis as athletes who trained more. And the presence of fibrosis, while it was associated with the development of these dysrhythmias, the dysrhythmias themselves didn't were not clinically relevant. So it was really kind of a mixed bag coming out of this study. That was the most recent thing I've seen on this. And I kind of came away from it kind of scratching my head and going, well, we're all worried about this reverse J curve. We have evidence that shows cardiac fibrosis is real, but is it clinically relevant? Is that really the cause of what's going on? I think there's probably a multifactorial thing here. I think we know that as athletes train a lot, their hearts get bigger, which also is an arrhythmogenic issue for athletes. So I think there's a lot of things that we just don't get yet and we don't understand. And I don't know. I don't know if there'll ever be a really satisfactory answer and great guidance. So I just tell people, do what makes you happy and make your individualized decision based on your own family history, your own risk factors, and don't worry about it. Don't make it an outsized worry. There are too many other things to worry about.
Yeah. And I, again, coming back to that point you made, that regardless if you're training a smaller amount or that kind of optimal amount for lifespan, for life expectancy, or more than that, you're still getting more benefits than a sedentary person in all cases for life expectancy and also for cardiovascular disease. And your discussion on that study leads nicely into the next subtopic here, which I do want to talk a bit more specifically about, which is the cardiovascular health. So what are, even though we've already discussed the big takeaways of just doing what makes you happy, I guess, but in terms of cardiovascular health specifically, are there some things that people should consider, like doing regular checkups and so on? What do you recommend there?
Yeah, it's a tough one because there have been a lot of studies that look at screening in athletes and have shown that you could spend as much time as you want screening, and it unfortunately doesn't make a whole lot of impact in identifying those people who are at risk. And so what I always tell people is, look, if you've been a healthy, active individual, getting random sort of screenings, especially if you're younger than the age of 40, is probably not going to be very helpful. If you are somebody who is kind of later in life, you're in your 30s or 40s, you're maybe overweight, maybe you have a family history of some heart disease, and you are thinking of now, you know what, I want to get up off the couch, I want to do something, I want to become active, it's probably not a bad idea to go and see a physician before you do that, get a cardiogram, maybe get some markers like cholesterol levels, things like that, just to see where you're at and be sure that you're not going to have a problem. But beyond that, I don't think you need to, as long as everything comes out normal the first time, you probably don't need to be doing that on an ongoing basis. If you're an older athlete in your 50s and you've been healthy up to that point, the recommendations are probably to get at least a resting cardiogram at some point. But if you're asymptomatic, it's probably not going to be that helpful. And so the most important advice that I give people is to just be very, very aware and to pay attention to your body. People often, especially us as athletes, we are so quick to kind of write off little things. I have too frequently heard from people, something terrible happens, an athlete collapses from a cardiac arrest, and only in retrospect do people then tell stories of, oh, you know, They were saying how they were more short of breath than usual on their bike rides or runs, and they didn't do anything about it. It's those kinds of little things that get ignored that then end up turning into big things. And I tell people all the time, especially once you're into your 50s, and especially if you have any kind of family history of heart disease, those little things, anything, unexpected shortness of breath, unexpected fatigue, unexpected, certainly any kind of chest discomfort, those things need to be taken very seriously and should prompt evaluation, because it could be nothing, but it could be something. And if it is something, better to find out when you are not in a event than to find out the hard way that it was something serious.
That is great advice. Is that something that would your heart, if you're actually out training when you have like some kind of small symptoms, precursor, would that would your heart rate data be able to potentially pick up or confirm what you're feeling potentially?
So heart rate monitors have really revolutionized this. I work as a full-time emergency physician, and it is not uncommon that someone will come in and say, my Apple Watch or my Garmin picked up some crazy heartbeat, and we can look at that data and see that they're right. Something was clearly amiss. And so I definitely tell people, pay attention to that. If you're wearing your heart rate monitor all the time, just keep an eye on it, because if your resting heart rate is much higher than it should be, that might indicate something's going on. If you find that you can't reach your normal level of heart rate when exercising, or alternatively, if your heart rate is much higher than it should be during easy exercise, those two things can indicate something is wrong as well. So yes, the heart rate monitor is a very valuable tool and should be at least considered as something that can be used as a potential warning sign and diagnostic aid.
That's good. And I think it makes total sense what you said about the main thing being just paying attention and taking care of things early, not ignoring things. It's the same with injuries, right? If you feel, when you first start to feel symptoms, you have a very good chance of nipping a potential injury in the bud that could be a much worse injury if you delay and only treat it after it's a full-blown injury. So it's the same kind of philosophy, but of course the potential outcomes are much more severe when we're talking about cardiovascular health and symptoms. Anything else on heart health, or should we move on to the next topic?
I guess the only other thing I would say is, if you are an older athlete and you have been diagnosed with some of the more common issues, things like high cholesterol or hypertension, there's this sort of like attitude amongst athletes that they don't want to be taking medications because they're afraid of interfering with their ability to perform. And I understand that, but you want to talk to your physician and just have your physician understand that you're an athlete and you want to be sure that whatever medication you need to be on is not only necessary, but something that is not going to interfere, because there are all kinds of different choices and options to treat the same problem. For example, beta blockers are a famous example of a medication that can interfere with exercise ability and are commonly used for treating high blood pressure. But it's not the only option. There are other medications that can be used that will have a much less or much lower impact on exercise ability. So you shouldn't not, well, that's a double negative. You definitely don't want to avoid taking medications when they're necessary, because things like high blood pressure is a very treatable cause of long-term heart problems. And while exercise itself is a great way to lower blood pressure, if you need to be on medications, definitely follow your doctor's advice. And it should be a collaborative relationship between you and your physician, and make sure that he or she understands what it is you want out of that medication so that it matches what they want.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So then moving on, I want to talk about blood markers and laboratory tests, also maybe urine tests that you might take in a standard laboratory test. What endurance athletes specifically, some of these might go for everybody, but especially for endurance athletes here, what should they look for in terms of the most important markers that might be off out of the desired range, the normal range, potential deficiencies or excesses, I guess? What would you recommend? And also then, how often would you recommend doing these sorts of tests?
So there's a huge industry now of marketing these very broad panels of blood and urine tests to endurance athletes. And it's really remarkable to me that this has taken off and has become a very successful business model. And I think it's really unfortunate, because the reality is, in medicine, we have gone the opposite route. And we used to do a lot of testing, a lot of kind of standard, just annual testing. And we've gone the other way and said, you know what, we realize that doing a lot of testing is not only a waste of time, it's a waste of money, and it just causes us to find a lot of false positives and false negatives that we didn't really need to know about. And so testing in medicine tends to be guided much more by symptoms than, or by history, for example, family history, than anything else. And so we tend to try to test a lot less now than we used to. And I think what's happened is labs and all these other private companies have sprung up and are trying to fill the void that we've left behind and are marketing these very, I would argue, unnecessary, very broad panels to athletes. The truth of the matter is that for probably 95% of athletes, blood and urine testing on any kind of basis is just unnecessary. There are really two studies that are potentially useful. Iron is one, specifically for women. Iron studies are generally helpful. They don't need to be done on an ongoing basis, but I would say for any woman, especially who is menstruating, getting an iron level is a good idea. If it's normal, though, you probably don't need to be checking in on an ongoing basis, but I would leave that up to the individual to make that decision in consultation with their physician. The other one is vitamin D levels, but vitamin D levels are really fraught. The issue with vitamin D levels is that it depends on what metabolite of vitamin D you're measuring and where in the world you're having it measured, because there is no universally accepted normal range for the different vitamin D metabolites. So what might be accepted as a normal vitamin D level in one country is not necessarily normal in another country. So it's kind of not clear how helpful measuring vitamin D is, but I know that that is one that is commonly found to be deficient. And so it's certainly one that might be worth looking at. But outside of iron and vitamin D, there's no need to do just random testing. It's not particularly helpful in most cases. And if you're a healthy person who's eating a normal nutrition balanced diet, you're very unlikely to find anything useful from doing these kind of broad-based panels.
Yeah, that is very interesting to hear. Starting with vitamin D, are you aware of any research linking vitamin D deficiency to potentially increased risk of bone stress injuries, stress fractures, and so on?
There's a ton of research on vitamin D. I mean, it's vitamin D has been associated with everything from sepsis to different cancers to bone issues to all kinds of things. But the reality is most of the research has not shown that if you give vitamin D, you prevent anything, which is really fascinating. Sepsis is the best example, where vitamin D has been looked at in widespread infections that have very high mortality rates. And it looked to be so promising, but when you give vitamin D in any kind of way, it doesn't seem to change the outcomes in any appreciable manner. And we find similar things, unless you have a true bone disease like rickets or any one of these other kinds of diseases where vitamin D is involved, just taking vitamin D, unless you have a deficiency, is not necessarily all that helpful. There's been numerous studies that have looked at, for example, I had a bike crash several years ago. I fractured my scapula, my shoulder blade, and the orthopedic surgeon said, oh, you should take vitamin D. It's going to help with the hip bone healing. And I thought to myself, that sounds kind of made up. And so I went and I looked at it, and it turns out there's no evidence whatsoever to support that. There is zero evidence. Taking vitamin D does not help bone healing as long as you have a normal diet that's getting enough vitamin D. And I did, and there was no reason to think I was vitamin D deficient. Similarly, there's no reason to think that you're going to fracture a bone if you have a healthy diet. And you have to be profoundly vitamin D deficient in order to have weak bones. Again, that doesn't mean there aren't people out there who don't need to be supplementing with vitamin D, especially if you live in a place where it doesn't get enough sun, if you live in a place where your foods aren't fortified with vitamin D, or if you live in a place where if you're a person who just doesn't eat a lot of vitamin D. So there are a lot of reasons why you might need to supplement with vitamin D, but in terms of the true benefits of supplementing with vitamin D, they are kind of hard to find in the evidence, because a lot of it, there's a ton of theory that suggests vitamin D should be helpful for a lot of things, but in terms of clinical practical benefits, evidence is a little bit sparse.
Interesting. My native country of Finland, at least some years ago, the public health recommendations recommended, had a blanket recommendation that everybody should supplement with vitamin D, because according to those recommendations, basically everybody in Finland was deficient, which you can understand theoretically because of the lack of sunlight compared to, because it's so far north and pretty dark as a whole across the year. So, but that...
Well, and I want to address that, because that's been a common sort of refrain. Northern countries in Northern Europe, England even had a similar kind of thing. Oh, we need to have everybody supplement with vitamin D. But it wasn't clear that there was this rash of vitamin D deficient related diseases. Like, kids in Finland weren't growing up with rickets. We didn't have people falling and breaking bones all over the place in Finland. This was based on conception that, well, it's dark, we're not getting sunlight, therefore everybody must be vitamin D deficient. And when people were being assessed for it, for whatever reason, I mean, people were obviously showing up because they weren't testing the population. They were testing people who were coming in and had a reason to be tested for vitamin D and found to be deficient. But again, whether or not that vitamin D deficiency was clinically relevant and whether or not they needed supplementation is anybody's guess. Now, if you're in the low range of vitamin D, should you supplement? Sure. I don't have a problem with it. I think it's benign. There's no real downside to supplementing with vitamin D. So if people want to do it, I have no problem with it. But just don't think that doing it is going to necessarily result in any kind of miracle or any kind of major change in your overall health. Because, like I said, yeah, there are all these populations in northern countries who are ostensibly lower in their vitamin D, but the reality is a lot of their foods are fortified in vitamin D for exactly that reason, because of the sunlight issue and everything else. And they're, for the most part, they've been, as a population, I mean, Finland is renowned for having a pretty healthy population.
Yeah, that is true. And you always have the problem with correlation or causality. So somebody who has a weak bone structure might not go out as much and get as much sunlight. So they might be vitamin D deficient because of a weaker bone structure, rather than have a weaker bone structure because of lack of vitamin D. So those things are always really tricky. And I think that as a species as a whole, we do tend to suffer from naive interventionism and what you say there about reducing the amount of testing that is done speaks to maybe starting to understand the limitations a bit on what we can achieve with testing and so on. So then the other follow-up then is on iron. Can you explain a bit more when for the athletes that are interested in doing that, especially the menstruating women, as you say, how would you do the test? I think that you should test for ferritin and maybe serum iron as well. But what is it that you're really looking for? Because this is something that I have actually had to look up in certain capacities, and I found kind of conflicting instructions for interpreting these kinds of iron tests. So can you clarify this a bit?
Oh yeah, iron studies are Byzantine. They're very hard to interpret. I don't even do a good job of interpreting them. The way I think about iron studies is really, there's two ways to think about iron studies. Are you iron deficient but have a normal hemoglobin, or are you iron deficient and anemic? Because if you're just iron deficient but have a normal hemoglobin, it's not really as important. You should probably still be taking some iron supplementation, because if you're iron deficient but have a normal hemoglobin, you are at risk for developing anemia. But if you're iron deficient and anemic, meaning that you have a low hemoglobin, then yeah, you 100% you have very likely an iron deficiency anemia. So the reason iron is important, it's important for a few reasons, but the major reason it's important is because iron is the atom that is very integral in the hemoglobin molecule, and it is incredibly important because it is the atom that attracts the oxygen molecule in your lung. It binds it, it holds onto it, it helps transport it around your body, and then unloads it into the various tissues where oxygen is then used and metabolized. Without iron, hemoglobin would be useless. It would have no ability to hold on to oxygen. So iron is that integral atom within hemoglobin. And if you have iron deficiency, then your ability to build or construct hemoglobin in red blood cells falls, and you end up with a falling total red blood cell, total hemoglobin count, and you become anemic because you have less red blood cells around. So when we do iron studies, there are a few things we can measure. We can measure ferritin, which is the protein that binds iron to it. We can measure just serum iron. We can measure total iron stores. There's all of these different things. But basically, the two that we're interested in are really ferritin and then the iron level. Ferritin will often fall before the iron level does, and ferritin gives you kind of a snapshot of the total iron stores. The iron is the thing that will fall last, because as serum iron levels begin to drop off, then it's liberated from ferritin, so it usually stays at a normal level before anything else. But the two things you really care about are really the ferritin and the hemoglobin. Those are the things that I look at. If the hemoglobin is low, then the ferritin is certainly going to be low. Unless it's not an iron deficiency anemia, there are other causes of anemia. So that was a very long, you'll probably want to edit some of that out. But basically, if you get iron studies, ask your doctor to help you interpret them. But basically, if you are not anemic and your ferritin is low, then you should have a conversation. If you're a woman, you probably should be supplementing with iron. If you're a man, then you may be okay just to increase your dietary sources of iron. So, and the reason I distinguish between men and women is because the number one cause of iron deficiency anemia is blood loss. Because when you're losing blood, you're losing iron. Now, if you're a man and you have iron deficiency anemia, there's two reasons to have that. You either are getting inadequate iron in your diet, or you are losing blood somewhere. And so it's very, very important as a man, if you have iron deficiency anemia, you need to get a check for colon cancer or any kind of loss of blood in the colon, because that would be the number one way that a man would be losing blood and develop iron deficiency anemia, if it's not because of inadequate dietary intake. If you're a woman and you have iron deficiency anemia and you are menstruating, then it's usually menstrual blood loss with inadequate repletion of iron that's being lost in the monthly menses. If you're a postmenopausal woman and you have iron deficiency anemia, then you are in the same boat as a man who has iron deficiency anemia, and an occult loss of blood needs to be looked for. If it's not a dietary issue, you have to look for either a blood loss from, generally it's the GI tract, it's the gastrointestinal tract. So you just have to be careful about that.
Mm. And when we talk about hemoglobin in this context, is hemoglobin concentration a good enough measure, or do we need to get our carbon monoxide rebreathers and measure hemoglobin mass to be able to determine this?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, please don't go down that route. Just get your hemoglobin concentration, you'll be fine.
Okay. Regarding the diet and the dietary sources of iron and some potential supplementation, this can also be a more general discussion on also relating to vitamin D. But what kinds of diets would you maybe be particularly considering doing these kinds of tests? For example, vegans or vegetarians, would they need to test more often?
Yeah, so iron is available in two ways, two forms. It's available in an organic form and an inorganic form. So organic iron is basically iron that comes from animal products. Inorganic iron is from everything else. And organic iron is absorbed much better. And the reason for that is because organic iron is basically iron that's bound up in animal protein. So when you eat a steak, you are taking in a whole bunch of the animal hemoglobin, you're taking in a bunch of animal ferritin, you're taking in a bunch of animal myoglobin that includes iron, and all of that gets absorbed as a protein. And we are very good at absorbing proteins. And we take up those proteins, which happens to hold the iron, and we do a great job of taking that up. inorganic iron is just free iron molecules, which our body doesn't have a great way of absorbing. We don't do a fantastic job of picking that up. So if you take 100 milligrams of organic iron, you're going to absorb almost all of it. If you take 100 milligrams of inorganic iron, which you can get from all kinds of leafy vegetables, spinach is a great example, spirulina, one of my favorite things. I always talk about spirulina, which is not a leafy vegetable, but it's a blue-green algae that is available as a supplement that's very high in inorganic iron. But if you take 100 milligrams of inorganic iron, you're only going to absorb about a third. So only about 33 milligrams is going to get absorbed. So it's much harder to get a good amount of inorganic iron if you're not eating animal products. So as me, who is a plant-based diet, and anybody else who's eating a plant-based diet, you have to do two things. You have to take a lot more iron in order to get a sufficient amount. And you need to take the iron with something else, which is going to improve absorption. So for example, we know that taking iron with vitamin C improves the absorption. So if you take your iron in the morning and you combine it with a glass of orange juice, you're going to improve the absorption and maximize the absorption. So those kinds of things are things you can do. But to get to your question, yes, people who are on a plant-based diet, they probably want to get their iron checked at least once just to be sure. But as long as they're conscious of it, most vegans, vegetarians these days are very conscious of the fact that they need to be watching for foods that are high in iron, high in the B vitamins, which are another thing that come usually in animal products. So it's pretty rare to find vegans or vegetarians who are actually low on these things because they're so aware of it. But so many foods are now fortified. So it's really easy to find foods that are high and rich in these micronutrients.
Let me see, was there anything else that I had to follow up with on that topic? No, I think that's it for this topic. So then the next one I want to ask about was about oral health. And this is something that I guess just from a personal point of interest, or shall we say concern, this is one that I'm always thinking about as an endurance athlete, because when you train, especially when you train quite a bit with quite a bit of high intensity, you do end up consuming a lot of carbohydrates to sustain that intensity, which is often in the form of products or even just table sugar and things like that that are not so good for your teeth and your oral health in general. So can you discuss oral health considerations for endurance athletes?
Yeah, we have this joke in the emergency department. A lot of people come to the emergency department with dental problems. And the reason for that is because people are afraid of going to the dentist. The problem is I am not trained as a dentist. And I have this joke that I tell is I never once went to my dentist with a cough. So why are the people coming to me with their dental problems? But the reality is I actually had a dentist on my podcast because I wanted to ask some of these very same questions and I learned a lot. There is a huge issue with continually pouring all of these simple sugars and complex sugars into our mouth, because you're right. It's basically bathing our teeth with a constant source of fuel, not just for our bodies, but fuel for all of the bacteria that are in our mouth. Our mouths are really filthy places, but they're filthy places on purpose, because our mouths is the primary entry point into our body. When you think about it, our bodies actually have a pathway to the outside world, and it starts with our mouth. And so the bacteria that are in our mouth actually help protect us by actually acting as a first line of defense. They break down a lot of the sugars that get into our mouth. They do a lot of good work. But in doing that, they can also liberate a lot of toxic chemicals that then do damage to the teeth. And that is a potential problem. When I spoke to this dentist who came onto my program, he was himself an endurance athlete. And he said, the main thing that we need to concern ourselves with is not so much regulating what we take in, but rather just being good about continuing with good dental care, brushing our teeth regularly, flossing, and seeing a dentist on a regular basis. Because the time that you don't want to get dental pain is when you're in the middle of an event. That is not, and I've spoken to a couple of athletes, a good friend of mine who is an influencer, Triathlon Joe. He had a dental problem a couple of days before an Ironman, and he was miserable trying to find a dentist. You know, he was, rather than focusing on his event, he was focusing on trying to deal with this dental problem. And that's not to say he doesn't regularly take care of his teeth, but it's just an example of how you just don't want to have that problem come up. And so it's so important to make sure that you are taking care of your teeth. Another interesting point about oral health is that there are increasingly links between oral health and other diseases. It's not been definitively established, but it seems that people with poor dental health are more likely to have higher rates of cardiovascular illness, stroke, all kinds of other problems. And so there may be a link between what's going on in your mouth and what's going on in the rest of your body. And again, it may come back to this notion of how your mouth is that primary entry point to your body, and what's happening in there could have a protective or potentially deleterious effect on everything else.
Yeah, no, that's a good and clear summary. I don't think that I have anything else to follow up on there. So let's move on to some myths and misconceptions. And I don't have any here for you to discuss specifically. So I'm asking you, are you aware, or do you hear and see about any common myths and misconceptions when it comes to health and endurance sports or endurance athletes that you would like to maybe shed some light on and clarify?
I think there are two. When you sent me this question, I thought about it, and there were two that kind of popped up right away. And the first is that people decide to get into endurance sport thinking, I'm going to do this because this is the best way to lose weight. And I'm going to do this because I'm going to change my body and lose weight. And they're thinking, oh, look at all these guys out there running. Look at all these women on their bikes. They look so great. I'm going to get off the couch, and in a couple of months, I'm going to look just like them. And what people don't realize, the big myth, the big lie is that just doing the work is going to suddenly melt off the weight. And I think people don't understand when they get into the sport that if you don't fuel properly, you can't do the work. And you can't fuel off of the stores of energy you have in your body, because we are not well suited, as you undoubtedly have spoken about many times. We don't metabolize our fat stores all that well. We need carbohydrates, and the only source of carbohydrates are external. And I've spoken with nutritionists on my podcast many times, and invariably the conversation comes back to athletes who want to perform well need to fuel well. And so I think that people who get into endurance sport need to understand, if they're doing it for health reasons, great. And if one of those health reasons is weight loss, that's also great. And it will happen, but just don't expect it to happen quickly. It tends to be something that happens over time, because as you get fitter, your metabolic rate goes up, and you will metabolize those fat stores, but it's going to be something that happens not so much while you're exercising, but actually while you're at rest, because your metabolic rate is higher. So that's myth number one. And the second myth is that investing in tech or investing in supplements is a shortcut and can substitute for just putting in the work. Too often, I hear or get questions or see or have discussions with people where they've bought into this whole idea of, you know, oh, if I have this fancy new thing, or if I buy this product that's being marketed that, you know, Christian Blumenfeld uses, that's going to make me faster. And the hard truth is that for us average human beings who are operating somewhere in the 60 to 80% of our physiologic potential, there is no better thing that we can do than just do the work, because that's going to give us significantly more benefit than any little piece of thing, tech or any supplement that we're going to buy or put into our body.
Yeah, and I guess that also goes, since we're talking about a lot about health and medical issues today, it also goes for products and data and things more relating to that area in terms of general health and well-being. You can't buy that in a supplement or in a piece of data. It's more about it's the good habits that you have and can form.
100%. Yeah, 100%. I guess there's a third myth I had jotted down here, and that is the value and the quantity of salt that people need to take. I always crack up when I'm doing one of my events, especially if it's in a hotter environment, when I see people carrying around Ziploc bags full of salt, and they're just gobbling this salt down in the belief that somehow this is going to, salt has been made into this miracle cure for all that ails you. If you're cramping, you need salt. If you're dehydrated, you need salt. If you're bonking, you need salt. And I'm like, people are taking so much salt that they're just vomiting all the time because, you know, salt is a terrible irritant to the stomach. And yeah, absolutely, 100%, we need salt. But this notion that we need as much salt as people seem to believe is that there's this total disconnect between the amount of salt we actually need and the amount of salt that people are taking. And I wish we could get that back into a little bit better balance. I think everybody would be happier.
So what do you think is the range where we're talking about that people actually need?
Yeah, I mean, it varies, right? I mean, it is true. There are people who sweat more and lose more salt. There's no question. But this idea that you need to be taking 2,000 milligrams of salt per hour is probably pushing it a little bit. Most people can probably get by with 400 to 500 milligrams of salt per hour. And they're getting that in most commercial sport solutions.
Hmm. One follow-up I had on the first point you made there with the weight. I think this is quite a common misconception as well, that people think that the amount of energy you burn or expend is related to your relative exertion, how hard you feel that you're working, but it really isn't. If we take a bike as a good example, even if you're huffing and puffing, but you're pedaling at 100 watts, which is very much normal for somebody coming off the couch, not having any background in sports, you're still burning. Watts is a measure of energy per unit time. So it is a very objective measure of how much energy you are burning at that point. You have an efficiency factor, but that is not too variable on a bike, different on the run and the swim, of course. But on the bike, you can get a pretty accurate estimate of the energy expenditure just based on the average watts that you're pushing in any given session. So what you said there about the need for patience to become stronger, become fitter, to over time get that weight off, that makes complete sense, because it is hard to create a big or not that you want to create a big, but an appropriate caloric deficit when it takes you quite a long time to burn even a very modest amount of energy when you're very unfit and just coming off the couch. But then a few months down the line, when you're much fitter already and you can push 130, 140 watts, then at that point, that energy expenditure of that same bike session is suddenly quite a lot higher and creating that appropriate calorie deficit for the weight loss becomes much easier.
Yeah, yep, well said.
And so then, also another hot topic at the moment is anti-doping. And here, from the context of amateur sports, I guess most people are familiar, but maybe not everybody, that at least in Ironman events, you are subject to WADA's anti-doping rules. But there are certain health or medical conditions that may lead you to take medication or get treatments that violate that code. So one common example is testosterone replacement therapy. So can you talk about this topic in general and what athletes that compete in sanctioned events like Ironman, triathlons, and other events that follow WADA's rules, what they should be aware of and how they should approach potential health and medical interventions with this in mind?
This is a whole episode unto itself. I could go on for hours on this. To me, listen, doping in sport is, it remains a huge problem. It's something that all age groupers say that they are bothered by. And yet the organizations who put on these events seem unwilling or unable or a combination of both to do anything to address it. And in this vacuum, more and more people are taking free rein to do whatever they want. Because there is just no testing. I mean, I know there is some testing, but I mean, let's face it, there is no testing of age groupers. I mean, there are several hundred events around the world. If you look at PTO, Challenge, Ironman, between 70.3 full distance, I mean, they are testing less than 0.1%, if that much, of age groupers. So they're basically not testing anybody. And everybody knows this. And especially when you get into the older age groups, you look at some of these times and you scratch your head and you go, what the? I mean, when they find one pro who's positive, the outrage level goes off the charts. And legitimately so. It's not something we want to see. It's not something we want to believe is there. But again, because the testing is just so inadequate, you're not going to find more than one pro every so many months. And I just as an aside, I'm sure you feel the same as I do. I get so tired of the common refrain of, oh, it was something I ate. I just like give that up as an excuse. Like, I just don't want to hear that. Like, it's just an old, tired refrain that is come up with a new excuse or just cop to it already, because it's like nobody's buying that. Anyways, that's an aside. But look, age groupers are doping. There was a study that was done at Roth where anonymously, I think it was 15%, maybe it was 11%. It was between 11 and 15% of age groupers wholeheartedly admitting to doping. And they were doping with EPO. They were doping with testosterone. They were doping with all kinds of things. And they just outright said, yeah, oh, absolutely. No problem with it. And because they're not getting caught and because they're so blatantly okay with doing it, that is tainting the accomplishments of people who are clean. So I know two women who are world champions on 70.3 in their age groups, and they are phenomenal athletes. They work so hard. They are in the gym lifting weights. They are out there biking, running, swimming. They have had a track record of success for more than a decade, both of them. And they have had success at all different distances. And I know them personally. I know how hard they work. And I know that they don't cheat. But because of their success, and because we all operate in this environment of if you do well, and because nobody's tested, we just assume you're a cheat, they are painted with this brush, with immediate suspicion, because they're winning by large amounts. And again, this is not new. They've been winning by large amounts forever. It's terrible for them because they would love to be tested and show that they're clean, because it's, you know, they feel like they have to be tested to show they're clean because there's no testing and everybody just assumes that they're not. And there's all these other, it's just this ridiculous. We all go to these events and we just, if you're at the pointy end of the field, you just assume you're getting beat by people who are dirty. If somebody beats me by a lot, I immediately question, are they clean or are they dirty? And especially because I'm in a late 50s age group where, as you mentioned, testosterone replacement therapy. So this is like, again, this is one of these like boutique medicine kind of things. Testosterone supplementation didn't exist 10 years ago. Well, maybe 10 is pushing, but maybe 20 years ago, testosterone replacement didn't exist. This was not a problem. And suddenly it was made a problem because what happened was pharmaceutical companies came up with the ability to manufacture testosterone, but they didn't have a market for it. So they needed to create a market. So they developed, they made up a disease, low T. Oh, you have menopause. You have, you know, low testosterone. This is not a thing. It's called getting older. When you get older, your testosterone levels naturally decrease. So what they did is they just apply the testosterone levels that we expect to see in a 20-year-old to somebody who's in their late 50s and, oh, well, you have low T. No, you don't. You have normal testosterone for a 50-year-old. You should not have a testosterone level of a 20-year-old when you're 50. Because if you do, you're cheating. You're taking testosterone supplements. And they call it medicinal because I've been diagnosed with this fake disease called low T. Now, are there people out there? I know I'm going to get pushback on this. Are there people out there who actually have a medical problem where they actually have low testosterone? Yes, there is such a thing. It's called hypogonadism. There are problems like that, but they are a tiny fraction of the men who are walking into these clinics looking for testosterone. And let's face it, a lot of these guys going into these clinics are doing so for one reason and one reason only, because they know they can get it and it legitimizes their ability to get an anabolic steroid. And it legitimizes their ability to get the benefits of taking this anabolic steroid. So what are those benefits? Improved recovery, improved muscle mass, improved strength. Are there downsides? 100%. We know that taking testosterone for a long period of time leads to enlargement of the heart. It leads to cardiovascular effects. And we've seen this. I mean, look at all of the professional wrestlers who took anabolic steroids throughout their 20s. They all dropped dead in their 40s. They all dropped dead in their early 50s. It's because of all the cardiovascular effects from the anabolic steroids. So all of these guys who are taking testosterone right now listen, they're not taking it at the same levels, but they're exposing themselves to the same potential risks. And for what? Glory at a 70.3 so they could get a little plaque or something? I have never understood the what compels people to cheat for amateur sport, but clearly it's something. There's something psychological. There's obviously, we live in the social media age where it's kind of a me thing. And I don't understand it, but I'm sure there are psychologists out there who could give you a very good explanation as to what it is. But that's the big one that people take. But we also know that people are taking EPO. I don't know where they're getting it from. I can only hazard a guess. And if they're getting it from the internet, then I mean, heaven help them. I have no idea what the quality is or what they're doing and injecting into themselves. But if they're taking real EPO, that comes with some big problems too. EPO, if it's not monitored correctly, can result in very high levels of blood counts, hyperviscosity, and we've seen deaths in cyclists, professional cyclists who are on EPO because they end up with hyperviscosity and they clog the very small capillaries in their brain, their heart, their different organs, and they can die. So these drugs are not benign. They have associated health problems with them. And who knows? We haven't got enough data to see what the long-term consequences are for taking these things. Who knows if there's associated cancers or whatever. But again, most of these people who are using these things are taking them for short-term gain and are not going to be particularly bothered by any long-term potential negative effects. But I think the bigger negative effects are just to the sport itself and to all of us who are participating in it, who fear getting painted with that brush and who lose the enjoyment. And honestly, it behooves these organizations, Ironman, Challenge, PTO, Super Try, whatever, whoever it is, they are the ones who are going to find athletes dissatisfied, disaffected, not willing to participate if they feel the people all at the top are there because they're cheating. We have all said as age groupers, we're willing to pony up an extra $5 in our registration fee. Charge us all $5 extra to pay for drug testing. I think everybody has, when I've asked, everybody has said they're willing to pay that. So figure it out, guys. Because I think we're all sick of it and we want to see testing much more widespread.
Yeah, I do wonder how far $5 per person per race gets you, though. I have no idea, but that's the question is how much extra would you actually have to pay?
Well, 2,000 people in a 70.3, that's $10,000. $10,000 pays for a lot of drug tests. Listen, you're not going to get everything, right? You can't do mass spectrometry to look for every possible thing. But there are tests that you can do to look for the common things. And, you just need to look for things like EPO, testosterone, whatever. I mean, I used to work in a drug testing lab, but that was in my pre-medicine days. But there are, you could easily come up with an assay that could look for three or four things. And who do you test? Well, you randomly test the podium of every age group, and then you randomly test, say, one person in each age group who is in the top 20% or something like that. You know, just randomly test people, pull them aside at the finish, and say you've been randomly selected. And when they come to get their awards, you test them there. And I just don't see this as a huge ordeal. Everybody would have to, you know, that we're all signing this code that says if we qualify for world championships, we sign on to this anti-doping code. So I don't know. Seems like
we do that for every race. It's not just the world championships. It's every race. I'm pretty sure, unless I'm completely mistaken. Yeah, if you enter an Ironman race, or to my knowledge, any sanctioned event by most triathlon federations,
So give it some teeth. Give it some teeth. Test people.
Yeah. My assumption is that no listeners of this podcast are willingly doping. So my question really is about, what if you are one of those 0.1 or 0.01% of age groupers that do get tested at a race? And imagine the worst case scenario, you get an adverse analytical finding, but you didn't intentionally cheat. What is it in your like medical or healthcare interventions, medications that could have caused such an analytical finding that you can try to control for? What are there common things that you should look out for, or a common practice you should follow whenever you get prescribed a medication or some kind of medical intervention?
Yeah, well, WADA has a really useful website that lists and is up to date and can be easily found, that basically lists all of the current drugs that are not allowed. And it's called Global DRO. So you can find it at globaldro.com. You choose your sport nationality, you choose your sport federation, and then you could search by medications. And it'll tell you if the medication is banned in competition, if it's banned all the time, or if you need a therapeutic use exemption. And for example, I actually am on a medication that is banned in competition, but not banned in training. And so I called USADA and I asked them about it. I said, what do I do to get a TUE? And they said, so the medication I'm on is a medication that shift workers use to stay, because I work overnights, and it's a medication that is used to help with the overnights. And they told me, they said, we are well aware that this is a medication used by shift workers. We understand that its metabolites can stay in the urine for longer, and age groupers are generally not sanctioned if we find a metabolite for this medication. You don't need a TUE, but keep a record of this conversation, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I've done. And I think the thing is to be proactive. So if you're prescribed a medication, you're taking something, just check, see if it's on the DRO, the drug restriction list. And if it is, contact your organization, wherever you live, and just ask them, do I need a TUE for this? Be proactive. Don't try to fix the problem after you get caught, because that's a lot harder. But if you're proactive about it and you call them up and they say, that's a medication you definitely need a TUE for, they're very easy to get. And what I mean by that is, not if you're cheating. I mean, they're very easy to get if it's a medication you need to be on. Your doctor will fill out the form, submit it to your organization, and then you're fine. And then if you do get tested and it's found, you have the TUE, you're good. It's all fine. So just be proactive about it, just the way you are about everything else. We're all so meticulous about our training. We're all so meticulous about everything else. This is something to be meticulous about. And it really takes 10 seconds to check the DRO. And if you find your medication is on that list, it takes a little more effort to then go through the steps to figure out what to do. But honestly, it's not that complicated, and it's well worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great, great summary. And just on that Roth study, because I hear about it so much, I'm not sure if there are several different ones, but there's one study that I'm thinking of which I felt was very misinterpreted, because it included things like caffeine as the drugs. And I also heard some other things about the study methods, how they actually collected the data. So I will need to I'm not going to say that the data that you said were wrong or anything. I'm going to make a mental note to create a specific episode on any studies, all studies that have been done in terms of age group doping, and then I can maybe get some more clarity in that. But I just want to say that from my perspective, at least one famous study that exists in terms of age group anti-doping, I think that there are some holes in it, and so it shouldn't be taken kind of as gospel.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The devil's in the details. The study that I'm referring to was from this year, and it was a survey, and surveys are always fraught with problems. The problem is it's in German, so I had to kind of use ChatGPT to translate it for me, and I don't know how accurate that was, but my intern is actually working on it, and we are doing an episode on it next week. So we will have something coming out next week on this.
By the time this episode interview comes out, your episode will probably have launched before that. So I'll try to put a link to that in the show notes. So that's great. So then to finish off with a few general questions, reflective questions, not just about health and medicine, but also coaching, training, can be a bit of anything. First of all, what is something that you are trying to learn more about or are focusing on at the moment or recently?
Like so many others, I'm getting older. I'm getting a little bit slower. I waited for it to happen, and it's finally starting to happen. So I'm training just as hard, but the edge is definitely coming off. And so the thing that I'm really trying to figure out is how to tap into those reserves of speed as I get older, and it becomes a little bit harder to find them. And so that inevitable age-related decline that we all face, how do you forestall it? How do you leverage recovery? How do you leverage all of the different tools that we have to try to be able to stay at the forefront of your age group and even potentially find gains still?
And have you found anything so far? Any tips that you can share?
I mean, nothing earth-shattering. I think the biggest thing I have found is really listen to your body a lot more. We all experience it as we get older. It used to be you could put in two hard days in a row. I can't do that anymore. If I do a hard day, I need one or two easy days before I get back to another hard day. It's really been a kind of an interesting discovery process, but I find that when I listen to my body and I don't push too hard, I've had much better success in seeing gains. And this year I put in a big run block over the winter months, and I actually found myself setting new PR times on the run, times that I haven't seen in almost a decade. So you can still get faster, but it's a lot harder and it requires a lot more patience.
And what is something that you think differently about today than you used to?
Two things. A big one is the impact of consistency in training. I had, when I came into the sport, I really thought that I had potential, but I couldn't figure out why I didn't do as well as I did. And looking back, and I now have training data and training peaks for two decades. And if I look at my annual sort of training volume, I could see that for many years, I just would have these peaks and valleys where I would train really hard. And then I would have these periods of time where I either wasn't training at all, or I just was training at low volume. And when I really started to make gains, I saw that it was because I trained consistently, including over the off season. And it wasn't so much that I was training more at any one time, but rather that I was just training with this constant consistency. And it wasn't just like going out and doing garbage hours. It was quality hours consistently, day in, day out, month over month. And when I did that for a couple of years in a row, I saw these astonishing results for me. And really, that consistency is what I preach to all the athletes I coach. It's just be consistent. Find a way to make sure that you're not taking long periods of time off. If you're going on vacation with your family, work in an ability to do at least 30 minutes a day of something quality. And that over time is so, so important. And the second thing that I think about very differently now is the importance of the mental game. I, for the longest time, did not have a lot of self-belief. I used to spend a lot of time thinking, oh, the people finishing ahead of me are just genetically better than me. Or, you know, I just was convinced that it was about them and not about me. And it was only once I started working with a mental performance coach and started reframing my own approach to training and racing that I started seeing these incredible results and gains. And I now am a very, very firm believer in how much your own outlook and your own mental approach to training and racing can have huge impacts on how you perform.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And if you could magically give yourself a great skill or knowledge in one specific area, what would you choose?
That's easy. Swimming. I'm an adult onset swimmer, and I have struggled for over 20 years to try and become a good swimmer. And that's not to say I'm a bad swimmer. I mean, I started as I swam my first ever Olympic distance race, and I came out of the water in like 33 minutes. And now I can swim a half Ironman in about 33 minutes. But 33 minutes is still putting me a good, you know, 4 to 5 minutes behind the leaders of the swim in my age group. And the learning curve is so crazy shallow for swimming. And you put in so many hours and so many meters per week. And you just make these tiny little incremental. And, you know, now my incremental benefits or my incremental gains are being offset by the fact that I'm getting older and I'm getting these incremental deficits as well. So I'm just trying to keep up at this point. And it's just swimming is just so technical. And it's just amazing when I'm in the lane next to somebody who can really swim. And I'm just always humbled. So I wish I was a better swimmer.
And can you give 3 tips to amateur endurance athletes that want to improve their performance?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned them all at different points in this conversation, but I'll highlight them again. Resist the urge to invest in things and instead invest in yourself. If you're a new person in the sport, you are going to be overwhelmed by all of the different toys, especially if you're in triathlon, which is so tech heavy. And, you know, you go into transition and it's all about keeping up with the Joneses. And I got into triathlon and I was told right away, don't buy stuff. And what did I do? I bought everything. And you just want to buy more, 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 thinking that every little thing is going to make you faster and make you better. And the reality is that until the only thing I would say to spend on is a coach, because a coach is probably the best investment you can make. And I understand that's somewhat, self-benefiting because I am a coach, but still, I recognize that that was the biggest thing that I got a bang for the buck was getting a coach. But other than that, honestly, just investing in yourself, time, proper nutrition, recovery, those are things that you will get the most benefit for. The second thing I would say is, as I just mentioned, value consistency of quality over anything else. As long as you can be consistent with quality training, the rest of it is just not important. And then the other thing I would say is, never underestimate the importance of rest and recovery. Too often, I think as athletes, we think that rest days are wasted or that taking recovery after a hard day is a lost opportunity. And it takes a long time for athletes to learn how beneficial those days are and how beneficial rest and recovery is. And the sooner you learn that and the sooner you learn to incorporate that into your training, the better off you'll be.
Yeah, those are all great tips. And let's finish off with a rapid-fire question. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. The first one is, what is your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
My favorite book is a book that I don't even know if it's in print anymore. It's one that I picked up when I first started training 2 decades ago. It's called Serious Training for Endurance Athletes by Sleemaker and Browning. And it just taught me all about periodized training, taught me all about all kinds of stuff.
And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Took me a long time to figure this out, but focus exclusively on the things that you can control. And remember that the rest is noise. And this is going to be more than a sentence, but just indulge me here. I think the best example of this is Facebook groups of a race. too many newbies get into Facebook groups for a race, and I think it's hugely important. You could ask lots of questions. You can get a lot of help for a race. But the problem is, in the couple of 2-3 weeks leading up to a race, there's a lot of panic and anxiety in those Facebook groups. And I tell new athletes or athletes who are particularly anxious, just stop. Stop listening. Stop indulging in those, because all they do is they contribute to stuff that is going to raise your anxiety level without giving you any benefit. Focus on yourself. Focus on your ability to adapt to whatever happens on race day, and just ignore everything else. It's just noise.
Yeah, I did a couple of episodes recently, and I was kind of talking about the same thing as you do, and I use the term or the expression addition by subtraction. You can, in many situations, you can get more out of something when you remove things, rather than, but we're constantly looking to add things. This also goes to the thing you mentioned about gear and tech and stuff, products, but certainly also for all of the details that you see asked about in those Facebook groups, for example. So yeah, definitely agree. And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I've had the great pleasure of knowing Lance Watson since I started in the sport. And over the past several years, I've worked with him at Life Sport Coaching. And for the last 6-8 months now, he's been my personal coach. And he is somebody I greatly admire and look up to.
And finally, where can people find you, your podcast, social media, etc.?
So the TriDoc podcast is available wherever you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, all the usual places. I have a website, which is TriDocCoaching.com. The TriDoc podcast, TriDocPodcast.com is another website where you can find more about the podcast. I'm on Instagram at TriDocCoaching. And there is a private Facebook group for the TriDoc podcast. Just search for TriDoc podcast on the Facebook platform. And there's a couple of easy questions to answer, and I'll grant you admittance. And if you have questions, medical questions or otherwise, you can feel free to just drop me an email, TRI_DOC@iCloud.com. Be happy to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It was great to have a chat, and hope to do it again another time. Take care.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate being here.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to Jeff's podcast, the TriDoc podcast, which I recommend you check out, and of course his website and social media. Also, I have linked to a couple of related episodes on that triathlon show, kind of health and medicine related, longevity related episodes that I've done. So those might be interesting for you to check out. And of course, as I mentioned already, I've linked to the information about our Mallorca training camp in 2025. A couple of personal takeaways, one short and one long, from this episode. The first one, which is the short one, is that it was very interesting to hear Jeff's take on blood and urine tests, and that for the most part, they are not particularly useful. And this may be my own interpretation, but I'll add that not particularly useful if you don't have a specific problem that you're trying to solve. And to be completely clear, this, I'm not sure that Jeff said that or meant that, but that's my personal interpretation, just because of how I asked the question. I meant, when I asked about blood and urine tests, I meant that in terms of, for example, a regular yearly checkup, so not something that you do because you have an illness or an issue and your doctor has sent you to do a specific test. So that's the context that I was thinking of when asking the question, and that's why I think that this is also the context that Jeff answered the question in. But yeah, that was very useful and interesting to hear. And I personally just spent a pretty significant chunk of money on a full blood panel recently. So I was quite happy to hear that maybe I'll save that money next year. So yeah, definitely food for thought there. The second takeaway, and it's more of an additional perspective rather than a takeaway, and it's on the age group doping question. I don't really want to spend too much time on this. I'll give it a few minutes. I'll start a timer now and see how long it takes me. First of all, it is obviously terrible if age groupers are doping, especially intentionally doping just for the purpose of winning at a hobby. It is not okay in any way, shape, or form. But I have spent many hours since conducting this interview researching this, and I want to tackle a couple of issues with this new study. So first of all, this new Challenger Off study has not been published anywhere. It has not gone through the peer review process. It may be, maybe it's already approved but hasn't been published yet, or maybe it's in the review process and we will see it published within the next few months or so. I don't know. But basically, the only thing that we have is that a journalist has seemingly interviewed one of the researchers from the of the study and written an article and created a documentary on the basis of that interview. And I've heard it said from sources that I've spoken to the journalist that he seems to have a bias that it's not possible to do an Ironman without doping. The journalist, not the researchers. So take that for what you will. It doesn't really matter. But what matters is that we have a mainstream media article. We have a documentary. It's not really worth much or anything in terms of credibility. It's not worth more than my best guess or your best guess as for how prevalent doping is, because this new study has not gone through peer review yet and has not been published. So even though there are some results attached in that article, we cannot accept results just like that without actually getting the chance to read the complete manuscript, the study methods, and including the survey questions. I do want to talk as well about that number that was quoted in the article, that 11% of age groupers are doping. This same research group that have done this study at Challenger Off that has not yet been published or approved, they have conducted similar studies before. They are the ones that I mentioned having read at various races in Germany, for example, Ironman Regensburg. And in my opinion, these previous studies that you can find on ResearchGate or wherever, they have severe limitations because you don't directly answer a question about whether you've taken WADA-banned substances, but you answer a question on whether you have taken substances that you could only receive from a pharmacy or a doctor or the black market that could increase physical performance. Obviously, the black market is a bit more sketchy, but the pharmacy and doctor's prescription thing comes with dozens of examples where you could have taken something that does improve physical performance, but is completely legit, it's not doping, it's not a moral gray area. Just to give one example, higher dose iron supplements that are typically prescribed to people with anemia, you can only get that with a doctor's prescription in most countries. And if you have anemia, it definitely could increase performance, physical performance, but it is not doping. And it's not a gray area. It's not something that increases performance if you're already healthy and have healthy iron levels. And that is why it's not on WADA's prohibited substances and methods list. Note here that a difference could be if you're getting intravenous iron, then you might have to get a TUE depending on the amount. So that's something to keep in mind. But I'm talking oral supplementation of higher dose iron here. There are many other examples that are legit medical treatments that would fall in the same category of substances that could increase physical performance that you could only get on a doctor's prescription. And we don't need to talk about all the examples, but I can kind of understand why the researchers phrased a question like this. I see that perspective because I guess that they maybe wanted to put people more at ease to answer truthfully by not directly using words like banned or doping or WADA. But their survey methodology already used something called the randomized response technique, which already achieves this extra level of anonymity. It achieves the same end goal. So to me, in these earlier studies that have been published, where we do know what the actual survey questions were, they shot themselves in the foot a bit based on that poor phrasing of the question, because that would lead to many false positives. In my estimation, the vast majority of positives would be false positives, because I think that it would be more common that you get athletes with, for example, anemia and a number of other conditions that require some kind of medical supplementation, medical treatment, rather than actual hard doping. Based on that mainstream media article, the question used in this new Challenger Off study was the same. However, we have to wait and see the actual published research, because it could also be that the journalist just assumed that the question was the same as in the prior studies. So my point here isn't that we shouldn't judge the study before it's been published. We should wait and see what it says, and then we can assess the methodology properly. But my key point is that the numbers quoted in this article and even the numbers from the previous published research by this same group using the same methodology, which, by the way, is, as far as I've seen, the only group that has done these kinds of studies investigating the prevalence of doping in age group triathlon, these numbers are not at all reliable for these reasons. Everybody can have whatever hunches or gut feelings that they want about what the prevalence is, but the point here is that we don't know anything yet. We cannot quote these numbers as facts because of the limitations that exist. And I know there were a lot of posts about this whole thing on Instagram, and I am quite certain that none of those posters had actually read a single one of the peer-reviewed studies from this group on this, just the mainstream media articles. So that is another secondary big takeaway, is to just choose your sources of information carefully and be very critical about things that you see, like we discussed in last week's episode with Dr. Gabriele Gallo. But okay, I think that that's all I have to say on the topic. It was about 7 minutes in the end, so a bit longer than I expected, but that's all right. Let's move on to talk about our Mallorca training camp. So this is a one-week camp, 7 nights, 6 full days of training, check-in and check-out days around that. We will be based in Alcudia, close to the gorgeous Tramuntana Mountains in Mallorca. And the dates are the 5th to the 12th of April, which is Saturday to Saturday. Prices are from 910 euros per person, and this includes the 7 nights at the 4-star hotel, which is a very nice resort hotel, breakfast and dinner every day, access to the hotel spa every day, access to all training facilities, and of course, all of the training and coaching over the course of the week. I'll keep it really nice and short here. Just go to scientifictriathlon.com and click through to the training camp page, or use the link in the episode description and read all about it. And then you can email me with any questions or register your interest in the form on the page. And then I'll contact you with the next steps from there. We had a full camp last year and had to turn people away at the end. So please register sooner rather than later to ensure that you have a spot. And you can also get a full refund until the end of January if you have to cancel later on. I hope to see you in Mallorca, and please email me with any questions you may have about that. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesimcare.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.